From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor with National Journal, and David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. And here are the issues. After months of indirect intervention, Russian troops in large numbers invaded eastern Ukraine to prevent the defeat of pro-Moscow separatists by Ukrainian forces. The escalation showed that U.S. and European sanctions against Russia have not been sufficient to change Russian leader Vladimir Putin's determination to prevent a united Ukraine from aligning itself more closely with the West. In Iraq, more U.S. military strikes kept the Islamic State from further advances, but the group continued to seize territory in Syria. President Barack Obama ordered U.S. drones to conduct surveillance of IS positions in Syria in preparation for possible airstrikes there as well. Another ceasefire was reached in the Gaza War, giving exhausted Palestinians and Israelis a chance to reflect on what, if anything, was accomplished by 7 weeks of conflict that killed more than 2,000 people, most of them Palestinian civilians. And finally, in the United States, the parents of Michael Brown, an unarmed teenager shot dead by police in Ferguson, Missouri, buried their son. A few days later, a 9-year-old girl accidentally shot and killed her shooting instructor with an Uzi submachine gun at a recreational shooting range in Arizona. Lots to talk about this week. David, let's start with Ukraine. It had fallen somewhat out of the news lately, given everything else that's been going on in the Middle East. But now we had a summit between Putin and Petro Poroshenko, the Ukrainian leader, followed by a massive invasion, let's call it what it is, even the Obama administration doesn't want to call it that, invasion of Russian troops into eastern Ukraine.
That's right. And the response from the West, and we're really talking about the response from America, which is the only country with us, it is the global superpower that enforces these rules, that effectively I think we are going to allow him to do this. You know, it's quite clear we were never going to have a shooting war between the United States and Russia. President Obama in a press conference made that actually explicit. So what next? We assume Vladimir Putin wants, by all accounts now, a land corridor between mainland Russia and the chunk of Ukraine that he grabbed a few months ago, that his separatists grabbed a few months ago in Crimea. What happens next? Is there any kind of crumbs of comfort to grab from this very depressing kind of process? Well, I think if you want to look for some comfort, we also have a big summit of the NATO countries coming up in Wales. And before that, President Obama is doing something smart. He is visiting one of the former Soviet republics, Estonia, one of the three Baltic republics, which regained their independence when the Soviet Union collapsed. And he's going to Estonia, which has, of all three of them, by far the best government. And he's going to make a very sort of firm statement that even if, to be bluntly realistic, we are not going to have a shooting war over what happens inside Ukraine, once countries like Estonia or Poland or the Czech Republic left that Soviet bloc and became part of the West and joined the European Union, joined NATO, that changed things completely, that there is a legal binding treaty obligation.
There is a red line.
There is a red line. Yeah. And people close to the president have told me when I've interviewed them that, you know, don't forget, he is a constitutional lawyer. So he takes that sort of thing extremely seriously. You can get depressed about his willingness to view the rest of the world as a bit of a jungle that is not his problem to sort out. But once you have a binding treaty obligation, that's serious. So we're going to see some big steps. He's going to go to Estonia, that's big symbolism. And then maybe actually as these NATO leaders meet, they may agree to have much more of a kind of permanent, semi-permanent presence right on Vladimir Putin's borders, just very close to Russia, which Putin will not like. So that's a crumb of comfort, an otherwise rather bleak moment.
Tom, I don't see too many crumbs of comfort in this. Are we just going to concede as much of Ukraine as Putin wants to him? Is Obama going to sell or provide weapons to the Ukrainian military? I mean, so far there's only been so-called non-lethal aid, and there have been sanctions, but they clearly haven't done the trick.
Well, I think his preference is for yet more sanctions, and I think he's going to try to persuade German Chancellor Angela Merkel to encourage NATO to ratchet up more sanctions. I don't think he wants to give more aid, but I think he might have to. Putin only respects strength, and he thinks that the U.S. and the West will not move against him militarily because it will complicate the Western economies, particularly the European economies. I think his real end game is to foment more or less permanent instability. I don't think he wants to overthrow the Ukrainian government. I think he's hoping that new elections that are coming later in the fall in Ukraine will elect more members to the Ukrainian parliament, supportive of Russia and Putin. But he wants to keep the pot stirring in Ukraine so that at the very least Ukraine does not get more interested in joining NATO or having more Western involvement.
David, is it just to keep the pot boiling, or is it to really, you know, seize portions of Ukrainian territory and make them Russian? Putin is somebody who has talked about the collapse of the old Soviet Union as being, you know, the greatest catastrophe known to man.
And my colleague in Moscow for The Economist, who's an extraordinary sort of intellectual, who's been writing a lot for years before other people about, it's not just about nostalgia for the Soviet Union, that's too simple. Fascinating sort of signs that Vladimir Putin is steeped in this very strange intellectual world of the 1930s, this mystical, nationalist, religious, orthodox idea of Russia as a sort of unique halfway point between the decadence and softness of the West and the barbarism of the East. And it's this kind of orthodox, rigorous, Christian, sort of manly, muscular sort of purity that he sees Russia presenting. And that is his kind of worldview, that he's trying to kind of create this alternative between a sort of soft, decadent West and the East. I think, you know, we can get depressed about the fact that he is going to grab chunks of Ukraine. I mean, we aren't going to go to war over Ukraine. What I think is tremendously important is not to forget what a test this is for Europe. So, you know, I used to work for years in Brussels as a European Union columnist. I actually had lunch yesterday with a very senior European official, deeply depressed, deeply worried about the fact that Europe is going to be tested in terms of whether we even believe in our values at all. The flickers of hope on the European side is, you mentioned Germany quite correctly, they're the swing player in all this. Angela Merkel has been saying things about Putin which are much harsher. And, you know, there was a sense for many, many years where European leaders basically competed to suck up to Vladimir Putin and to say that he was someone who we could do business with, that the Americans were too aggressive towards him. That, at least, I think, is slightly on hold. You know, we're now, there is a big division in Europe, you know, between countries which see Putin much more clearly. But, you know, winter is coming. There are several European countries that get 100% of all of their gas that they use for heating homes during winter from Russia. So, you know, this is a gigantic test of European unity. But if they just kind of blink and do nothing, if France carries on selling these warships, that's really tragic for Europe. It means that Europe's sort of existence as a project of values is, you know, a joke.
Well, on that happy note, Tom, the NATO summit that's coming up is also going to talk about another threat to Western values, and that is the Islamic State. The U.S., of course, has stepped up. Its military involvement has become involved in Iraq again through airstrikes. And there were indications that these airstrikes might also extend into Syria. Now that looks less likely, at least in the immediate future. What is your sense of what the Obama administration is contemplating on Syria?
Well, I think the administration understands, at least intellectually, that if they're serious about dealing with ISIS, they're going to have to strike ISIS base camps and command and control centers inside Syria. I spent 22 years in the military, almost unerringly. When the Pentagon starts overflights for intelligence gathering, that is almost always a prelude to actual military action, airstrikes. And so I think even President Obama, who is reluctant to do something of a military nature, I think even President Obama understands that if you're going to get serious about a problem that which he has described as increasingly grave and dire and serious, you got to go after ISIS in Syria. Now, the difference is, of course, ISIS has a lot of weapons, but they don't have top-of-the-line weapons. But the Syrian air defenses are still among the more sophisticated in the world. They have a lot of frontline Russian-supplied surface-to-air missiles. Some of them can even strike aircraft at 65,000 feet, over 13 miles. And if you're going to launch strikes against ground targets in Syria, it's pretty hard to operate at that level. So if the president launches airstrikes against Syria, he will have to confront Syrian air defenses. Now, I think the president does not worry about violating serious sovereign airspace. I think he's prepared to do that. And in fact, that's already been done once. Several weeks ago, U.S. Special Forces entered Syrian airspace to try to rescue the American captive James Foley, now beheaded. So it can be done. And I think it'll have to be done. And sooner or later, President Obama is going to have to explain to a very war-weary country why this has to be done.
David, obviously their complication, I'm not so sure that the U.S. would have to worry about Syrian government air defenses, since the Syrians are presumably on the same side against the Islamic State. That is the complication, isn't it? The United States doesn't want to do anything that would wind up strengthening Bashar al-Assad.
Well, you have two strategic objectives of the United States in direct contradiction. And you can see now voices kind of at the most, you know, realist realpolitik ends of politics saying, embrace this. You know, embrace Assad. Time to forget the sort of romantic nonsense about, you know, objecting to Assad's massive civilian slaughter. Time to ignore the fact that his hands are dripping with blood. We need to embrace this man. We have no choices. He is in control of the situation. He is the key to attacking the Islamic State in Syria. I sometimes think that we in the West, in kind of liberal democracies, we overestimate the brilliance and strategic kind of genius of our opponents, and we underestimate our own strengths and positions. I mean, on this one, the idea that Assad has all of the leverage and that we will have to go crawling on our knees to this butcher in order to try and attack Islamic State, that seems to be the kind of message, you know, man up and just admit that's what we're going to have to do. Why doesn't he need us more than we need him? I mean, Assad is the man who is more directly threatened by the Islamic State than we are. You know, Islamic State certainly can train Western passport-holding jihadists and they can cause terrorist attacks. But for the moment, the person whose national security interests are at stake is Assad, not us. So it seems to me we have all the leverage in this, and we should be using that in much more sort of powerful ways.
Tom, you want to say something?
Barbara, some would argue, and I guess I'm one of them, that we have, to all intents and purposes, already embraced Assad. I think if the United States and the West really wanted to get rid of Assad, he'd be gone. But I believe there is a thread in Western foreign policy which says Assad, as horrible as he is better than the unknown
chaos,
or the ISIS, and he has brought a modicum of stability to a crazy situation. So, I mean, it's the old politics makes strange bedfellows. Global politics sometimes makes even stranger bedfellows.
Well, just for clarity, that's not my position, and the economists, I think, we would not want to back Assad.
We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on The Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of El Monitor. Joining me today are David Rennie of The Economist and Tom DeFrank of National Journal. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com. Let me, if I may, take the moderator's prerogative and enter this debate just a little bit. I think there may be a way to work against ISIS without necessarily bolstering Assad, and that is if the intervention in Syria can be part of a renewed diplomatic initiative to find another government for Syria. We have precedent, I've written about this actually for VOA, we have precedent in what happened in Iraq, where Maliki, who had been strongly supported by the Iranians, even to some extent by the U.S., was pushed aside in favor of a new prime minister. This, by the way, has allowed the first high-level meeting to take place between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Since Hassan Rouhani was elected a year ago, there was a meeting of a deputy Iranian foreign minister and the Saudi foreign minister, Saad al-Faisal, in Jeddah just a few days ago. Very important. The rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia has been one of the most corrosive elements of the conflicts we've seen in the Middle East. And if these two very important powers can start talking to each other, then we can begin to see maybe a road forward in both Iraq and in Syria. Assad, Tom, is not just damaged goods. He's damaged beyond repair. And there are increasing indications that even the Alawites in Syria, his religious minority, have had it with him. Just a few days ago, IS took a very important airbase in Raqqa province. Many Syrian soldiers were killed. They were paraded through the desert and then apparently all shot. It was extremely horrifying. It's not just Americans who are being beheaded and murdered by IS. It's also Syrian government soldiers. So if there were a way to preserve what is left of the Syrian state, minus Assad and his family, I think there would be a huge sigh of relief among all Syrians.
I think Tom is absolutely right to say that in Washington, the mood is kind of one of extreme pragmatism and a willingness to contemplate unpleasant choices. But I thought it was incredibly revealing that during his press conference this week, President Obama talked about needing to find a Sunni solution. Because his, you know, one of the keys to this is when you speak to people around the sort of White House and the NSC, he has been deeply, deeply concerned not to get dragged into a Sunni versus Shia sectarian fight, that America should not be the air force for one side or the other. And of course, President Assad, whose Alawite minority is broadly allied with the Shia, and that's therefore, you know, Iran is the Shia superpower. And so a meeting between Iran and Saudi Arabia is essentially a meeting between the Shia superpower and the Sunni superpower. You know, his vision that you need a Sunni solution to this, that the Sunni extremists of IS can only ultimately be reined in by Sunni governments that must stop funding them, must stop turning a blind eye to them, must stop tolerating them, must stop believing that they may be a useful way of attacking the Shia. That, I think, is key to his thinking right now. Mm-hmm. And that points to your solution for kind of some sort of government of national unity, that same template that is being tried in Iraq, being tried in Syria. And I would love to see us using that same leverage. Look at the brutality with which Maliki was kicked out. You know, that was actually smart politics of President Obama to say,
absolutely,
you
know,
you
and
need
backed
our
by
air
force.
Power right now. Yeah. You need our air power right now. Well, guess what? It isn't coming until Maliki goes.
Yeah.
And Maliki went. That was really smart. So if we can do something similarly smart in Syria.
Yeah, I think that is the model, Tom, that judicious use of U.S. military force, but in support of a political strategy. And Obama, of course, said right now that he doesn't have a strategy. He is searching for the diplomatic, the political underpinnings for that.
And you, Barbara, you can just be certain that when the president said we don't have a strategy right now, there were cringes all across the West Wing. That's the sort of thing that a president should never say. I mean, I suspect hindsight is always easier, but he should have said something like, there's a reason why. I'm back from vacation 2 weeks before the Congress is back in another 2 weeks. Stay tuned. But the notion of saying we don't have a policy yet connotes that maybe there won't be one. And I think there will be one. I think Obama understands he's got to deal aggressively with this situation. But in terms of optics, and I mean, he did a great job of undermining his already weakened leadership credentials in this country by, in effect, saying we don't have a policy. His public utterances have not been as crisp or as smooth as, let's say, candidate Obama when he was running in the fall of 2008.
Yeah, a few more words. I want to turn to Gaza, but just a few more words on Syria. We've had an American journalist, Peter Theo Curtis, who was freed. He had the good fortune to be held by the Nusra Front, which is actually the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, and as such is less extreme than the Islamic State. There are apparently a couple other Americans that are still being held by IS. Nearly a dozen Americans are also fighting with IS, and one of them was killed. Douglas Arthur McCain, what a name. It's an incredibly complicated situation, but one can see also because there are Americans involved in this fight that Obama actually has, David, sufficient authority to use military force in defense of Americans, I suppose, or going against enemy combatants, however you want to look at it.
Yeah, I mean, we keep saying, you know, endlessly that this is a very war-weary country, and it is. But, you know, you can do stuff without really troubling the American public very much, as long as pilots aren't shot down, as long as, you know, it's missiles and airstrikes and even, you know, using drones if you want. I don't think there are obstacles to this. I don't think there was an obstacle, frankly, last year when President Obama said he had to go to Congress to get permission to strike Syria. I don't think he did.
Yeah.
And I don't think Congress actually wants to be consulted. When Congress stands on its hind legs and shouts that it demands to be consulted, the last thing they want is to actually be asked to vote on this in the run-up to the midterm elections in November.
Yeah, and as we know, I think Congress has something like 12 days that they'll be in session when they do come back, Tom, before they go off to campaign.
Yeah, the prospect of Congress getting anything done in the handful of days they have left to do legislative work is slim and none, but that, I'm sure, is a subject of another program. They don't want this to happen. I have said for years, I continue to believe, that the American people want peace, but they're always willing to support little wars as long as there are not huge concentrations of American forces on the ground and there are not a lot of American pilots being captured or killed.
Sure. Speaking of war weary, David, Gaza. New ceasefire, it looks like this one will hold for a while. more than 2,000 dead, nearly 500,000 Palestinians homeless, massive infrastructure damage. Did any side gain anything out of this? I mean, the polls in Israel aren't showing great enthusiasm.
Well, it's bizarre, isn't it? You're seeing, in effect, the conservative prime minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, being attacked from the right for not having achieved enough. And so he's forced to go on, you know, TV and say, well, you know, we killed 1,000 terrorist commanders and we destroyed their tunnels and we destroyed their arms arsenals. And it's the worst defeat that Hamas has suffered in many years. You then saw Hamas coming out and saying, you know, fantastic job. We're very proud of what we did. The 1.8 million people of the Gaza Strip are heroes. And so both sides claiming victory when it doesn't look like a victory for either side. And this particularly painful detail that effectively the ceasefire terms are identical
to 2012.
To 2012. Yeah. That said, I don't think that we are frozen in time. I think in that two-year period, and since these killings have taken place, some things have changed. I think things have changed the worse for the Palestinian side, but also for Israel too. I think Israel's diplomatic isolation continues to increase. I think it matters that Western European countries, which are essentially sympathetic to Israel, are increasingly unhappy about the direction of the Netanyahu government. I think that Benjamin Netanyahu's diplomatic room for maneuver when it comes to, you know, insisting that he won't go into the peace talks with, you know, this and that on the table, I think there is less and less patience in Western capital for his kind of absolutist positions. And Western public opinion. Yeah. Some of that is nasty anti-Semitism, but some of that is decent, ordinary people just thinking, this did not look like the actions of the Israel, the democratic, liberal Israel that we hold dear. This looks like an Israel heading down a path that we don't like.
Yeah, Tom, there was also a lot of economic damage to Israel. They lost essentially their entire tourist season this year. And indications, I mean, we may see some ramifications for foreign investment in Israel.
Yeah, no, I think there's a real downside for what Israel has done, both domestically, geopolitically, and economically, as you suggest, Barbara. I guess the real question is, how do you structure a political solution where Hamas is not part of the equation, because Netanyahu is insistent that a group that has vowed to wipe Israel off the face of the earth should not have power in Gaza. So the real question is, can the Egyptians broker some sort of an arrangement where the Palestinian Authority basically is able to function in Gaza, and Hamas is told to go stand in the corner? That's going to be hard. But I think that short of that, it's the rockets could be fired up again in a few months. Maybe sooner.
David, we're very quick to condemn the policies of governments around the world, but the United States, of course, is not immune from criticism. And I must say, there was a story in the last few days that even, you know, for someone who is inured to American gun violence, was over the top. We've had, of course, the terrible case of Michael Brown, and then just a couple of days ago, a 9-year-old girl was, how should we put it, having fun with an Uzi submachine gun and killed her instructor. When Europeans look at U.S. gun culture, I can't imagine what they are thinking.
I fear that I don't think there's going to be any prospect for gun control ever. And my take on this is that it's ultimately about power. And that's why it's impossible to rein this in. That basically, people who fight very strongly for gun rights, particularly for the right to kind of carry a gun around the supermarket on their hip. If you walk around a supermarket with a gun on your hip, or you insist that you should be allowed to own as many guns as you like, or that the response to a school shooting is to arm the teachers, they're essentially saying they want to award themselves the power of life and death over others. That's how they feel safe in the world. And I think that is a very, to some people, a very empowering feeling, and it is impossible to unwind that. I see no prospects for gun control of any sort in this country. I think it's over. We are now in a sort of completely armed America.
Well, thanks to the BBC, I have some sobering statistics. Nearly 10,000 people were murdered with a firearm in the United States in 2010. Nearly 10,000. So three times the number that were killed on 9/11. Killed through gun violence. And David, I believe you said The Economist did a survey that showed there is at least one gun per every American.
That's right. You know, and gun supporters will say, well, you know, in other countries they banned guns and crime went up. It's just not true. It's just, you know, they're making up their facts. look at police shootings. So we just had the terrible shooting in Missouri. The Economist again looked. In 2012, the American police killed over 400 people in justified shootings. So when they felt they had a reason to do it. The same year, the United Kingdom, which has a population about the fifth of the size of America's, the British police fired guns three times and killed nobody. The Japanese police killed nobody in a large country, you know, nearly 100 million people. So something is completely out of whack, but I see no prospects of it changing.
Tom, do you have the same dismal feeling about the Second Amendment?
I do. I mean, well, not about the Second Amendment, because I do believe the Second Amendment guarantees the right to bear arms. But our founding fathers certainly didn't envision that their Second Amendment would allow an insane situation like a 9-year-old girl from New Jersey on vacation in Arizona, just out, as you said, to have fun, firing a submachine gun. I can remember in the Army the first time I fired an M14 semi-automatic weapon, and that was quite a kick. And I also kick back on my shoulder. And I also remember the first time I fired AR-15, which was the main assault rifle of the Vietnam War, and I thought I was going to be knocked over. And an Uzi for a 9-year-old is just idiotic. And it just tells you that the gun culture is run amok in this country. And I think until politicians decide to say to the National Rifle Association, we don't care if you come after us, which I don't think is going to happen because they are too powerful and they've got too much money to throw at your opponents. I very reluctantly on this one agree with David.
Well, on that depressing note, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.